From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The ability to get a true citizens initiative into the Florida Constitution seems to be a heavier and heavier lift as time goes on.
You really have made it impossible for a true grassroots movement to get the signatures that they need.
Also this week, one question that's becoming more urgent in Florida: can the state cut or even do away with property taxes?
These property taxes are very important for our local communities, for school districts.
We'll also check out some backyard beekeepers and see how descendants of some original Florida residents are trying to keep their ancient culture alive in the 21st century. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. A citizens' initiative to expand Medicaid in Florida has been bumped back to 2028 instead of next year. Some political watchers say that's not a surprise after a law passed this year that made it harder to get proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot. Tristan Wood reports.
The new law introduced stricter regulations and penalties for those involved in petition drives. Mitch Emerson is executive director of Florida Decides Healthcare. That's the group behind the push to expand Medicaid, the state and federally funded health insurance program for low-income people. Emerson says the law has directly harmed democracy in Florida.
HB 1205 was about changing the rules in the middle of the game. And it was an attempt to put up hurdles and sabotage the effort of Floridians to participate in democracy through petition collection. Really, when the state threatens groups like ours with racketeering charges and massive fines for small paperwork mistakes, like, that is not about democracy, that's about intimidation.
The changes to state law included requiring ballot circulators to be Florida residents and American citizens, shortening the deadline to turn in signed ballots, requiring groups circulating petitions to post a $1 million bond, and more. A judge has temporarily blocked the circulator residency requirements from taking effect, but most of the other provisions are still in place as litigation is pending. University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett says the announcement from Florida Decides Healthcare didn't surprise him.
Because I think most political observers in Florida know that has been the intent of the legislature over a number of years, is to make it more difficult for people to gather petitions to change the Florida Constitution. And so this latest bill this past year was just one in a number of steps.
While the bill was going through committee, Fort Myers Republican Representative Jenna Persons Mullica argued the goal of the measure is to keep out-of-state wealthy interests from changing state law, pointing to abortion rights and recreational marijuana ballot initiatives that failed by slim margins in 2024.
Now the process has been taken over by out-of-state fraudsters looking to make a quick buck, and by special interests intent on buying their way into our Constitution.
Jewett thinks the new law hasn't had the same impact on large initiatives because he says they can afford heightened costs, but smaller efforts like Medicaid expansion are facing bigger effects.
And the restrictions they've put on, the fines and potential for felony charges that they put on have made it, I won't even say virtually impossible, it really have made it impossible for a true grassroots movement to get the signatures that they need.
More than 1 million Floridians are in a health care coverage gap. They earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but they cannot afford private health insurance. Federally, Medicaid is set to be cut by almost $1 trillion over the next 10 years. Emerson says his group is not deterred from trying to get the proposal on the ballot in 2028. He says, especially with those cuts, Floridians need Medicaid expansion.
I think that bringing in $10.5 billion of Floridians' federal tax dollars from, instead of sending it to states like New York or California and keeping it in Florida, that's going to help keep hospitals open. That's going to keep doctors in our state. It's going to improve coverage. And without it, we're going to be looking at something like 50,000 jobs lost and $5.2 billion in uncompensated care.
Florida is just one of 10 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida lawmakers have begun exploring how to reduce the state's property tax. They believe some local governments charge too much. At the same time, the state is reviewing spending through its DOGE team. We get more on that story from WUSF's Douglas Soule.
Margie Morrison Richardson's family has lived in Florida for generations. In fact, Morrison Springs in the Panhandle is named after them. She and her husband live in the small Gulf Coast community known as Carabel.
Florida is home. It's a lifestyle. It's family. It's where I live, where I grew up. It's memories. And it's changing.
She says it's gotten too expensive. That's why there's a for sale sign in front of her house.
It'll be $1,000 a month just to live in Florida. And that's for taxes and insurance. So that's caused us to just reevaluate.
Earlier this year, Governor Ron DeSantis endorsed targeting property taxes. His calls have grown louder.
I want property tax relief more than anything, and so that's what we're going to deliver.
He says local governments are charging residents like Richardson too much. He's also against the tax in principle.
If you own your home and that's like your primary residence and you have a homestead and everything like that, I don't see why how government has the right to keep asking you to pony up infinitum to just pay rent to them.
State lawmakers are just starting to explore options. Republican Representative Toby Overdorf is the co-chair of a new House committee. He questions some local governments' spending practices.
There are cities that are doing it right and that are spending the taxpayer dollars equitably, and there are others that aren't.
The committee met in the Capitol on Monday and Tuesday. Lawmakers received an hours-long crash course on how Florida's property taxes work. They also heard from local officials who warn reducing the tax will hurt services like education and public safety. Casey Cook from the Florida League of Cities says if residents don't like what their local officials are doing, they have the power to make their voice and vote known.
Waste is in the eye of the beholder, and the way that cities budget, they budget based on the priorities expressed by their residents. Cities are forced to operate in the sunshine.
How much lawmakers will try to reduce the property tax and how exactly they'll try to do it is still unclear. The nonprofit Florida Policy Institute says one option, getting rid of the tax on people's primary homes, would cost counties, cities, and school districts around $18.5 billion every year. The Institute's CEO, Sadaf Knight, says governments would either have to raise taxes and fees elsewhere or be left with tough budget choices.
These property taxes are very important for our local communities, for school districts, for providing really critical and important services that we all depend on.
She says targeting the property tax is not a real way to provide relief to Florida.
What we need to see is addressing these other issues to address affordability when it comes to housing, when it comes to property insurance, not eliminating property tax or significantly reducing property tax, which in turn is just going to negatively impact all of us anyway.
Jacksonville homeowner Susie Stone is a retired pharmacy rep. She wishes lawmakers would focus on insurance.
For me personally, the real problem is not property taxes, it's my homeowner's insurance. My homeowner's insurance has gone up exponentially at a greater rate than my property taxes have.
She recently managed to get her insurance costs down, thanks to a relative who works in the industry. Others aren't so lucky. Carabel resident Margie Morrison Richardson also pays a high price for insurance. She agrees the state should do more about the insurance market. But she still thinks something needs to be done about property tax. Some lawmakers are talking about providing targeted relief for older Floridians. Richardson, who's retired and in her 60s, supports it.
I believe that after you get to a certain age, you've paid your debt. You know, give us a break. We work hard. We've paid our taxes.
Meanwhile, her for sale sign stays up. She says prices have gotten so high, it's hard to find a buyer. Florida voters will have the final say. Proposals are expected to appear on the 2026 election ballot. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a change in Florida law could be used by some developers to place new construction in places in greatest danger of storm damage.
And trying to get policies that they opposed but lost on and trying to get those retroactively dissolved using this law.
With at least a portion of its world-famous oyster production reopened for harvest, what does the future hold for the economy of coastal Northwest Florida?
Those oyster bars aren't healthy and thriving, it affects fish all the way to 50 miles offshore.
And the descendants of Florida's native residents now struggle to keep their ancient culture alive. Is Governor Ron DeSantis working with developers to help exploit a hurricane relief law? WMNF's Chris Young spoke with investigative journalist Jason Garcia, who says the answer is yes. Garcia publishes the political newsletter, Seeking Rents.
The law was promoted as hurricane recovery legislation, but includes a provision barring cities and counties from enacting any development regulations deemed, quote, more restrictive or burdensome.
And so what you are seeing now is developers around the state are taking advantage of this provision by using it to both block new policies that they don't like, that some city councils or county commissions are trying to enact, or going back and trying to get policies that they opposed but lost on, and trying to get those retroactively dissolved using this law.
And Garcia calls Manatee County ground zero for this. The county voted to increase impact fees, a tax on home builders designed to raise money to pay for infrastructure due to new development and population growth.
And obviously, home builders despise impact fees. And so a group of home builders have argued that Manatee County is forbidden from raising impact fees because of Senate Bill 180, because raising impact fees would make development more restrictive and burdensome. And so in this case, it's the law is less clear on whether or not impact fees actually qualify under this or whether or not Senate Bill 180 applies to this. So these developers, who include a guy by the name of Pat Neal, who founded a company called Neal Communities, also a business run by a guy by the name of Carlos Baruff, who founded a company called Medallion Home, they have sued Manatee County to stop them from raising impact fees, claiming that is a violation of Senate Bill 180.
Garcia says a stern letter from the DeSantis administration has been used in the lawsuit, and other issues not only in Manatee County, but statewide bring up a larger question of home rule and local government authority. I'm Chris Young.
The Apalachicola Bay is known worldwide for its oysters. They were a major economic driver in the area for decades, but the bay has struggled for a generation. 5 years ago, the state closed the bay to wild oyster harvesting, and now, as the state considers a partial reopening, some who live on what's called the Forgotten Coast wonder if their economy is changing yet again. Margie Menzel reports.
Apalachicola's economy hasn't always been based on seafood. According to the city's website, the timber and cotton industries were prevalent before the Civil War until well into the 20th century. Rail commerce flourished until the timber resources dwindled, and Apalachicola was once a major part of Florida's sponge industry, at one point ranking third in the state.
They used to free dive the sponges back in the day, and then they went to the hard helmet diving with the suits and the forced air into the helmets.
Jerry Garlick has been in the sponge industry since 1995 and runs a sponge shop in Apalachicola's tourist district. There he displays one of the old diving suits with a bell helmet.
The only divers that use that method today are the deep sea divers who work on oil rigs and they have to go very deep.
Garlick says the sponge trade has drifted south to Carabel, Cedar Key, and Tarpon Springs, partly because sponges thrive in deeper water. But they need the same mix of salt and fresh water that the oysters do.
A lot of the divers from Apalachicola moved because they had Greek relatives there. This was once a Greek town here in Apalachicola, too. So they harvested oysters, mullet for fish, the sponge, blue crabs. This was once a very thriving area for seafood and the sponge industry.
Apalachicola's seafood industry goes back more than 175 years, shaping its culture. Oysters came first, sold locally as early as 1836, harvested with scissor-shaped tongs, the same tool wild harvesters use today. But as the health of the bay has dwindled, largely because of water issues, including what many say is an overdraw from bigger cities upstream, the oyster and seafood industry has dwindled too.
The commercial seafood arc ended around here. That was, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s when that really started to turn.
Apalachicola City Commissioner Adrian Elliott is from a family that's lived in the area for 8 generations. They've run merchant lines and been involved in the seafood trade. Her grandfather served on the city commission for 36 years, and when he retired, she ran for his seat and won.
Around the 80s is when Apalachicola established our historic district. So that's when you can see a marked turn towards heritage and ecotourism. That's around when St. George Island started to develop from just an empty island sitting out there to the tourist destination that it is now.
During her lifetime, Elliott says, she's seen the hospitality industry climb. But in 2008, when the housing market crisis caused a global financial panic, they felt it in Apalachicola.
And then everything after Hurricane Michael, that severely impacted a lot of restaurants and families, blue-collar workers that were in the economy here that were either forced out because they didn't have a job to go back to anymore. And then you have COVID, and it was a lot of the same problem. If you worked in hospitality or service, you couldn't go to work, or it became very, very difficult to do your job. A lot of people left the industry and took their families and moved to other areas.
Now, as the state considers reopening the bay, people like Franklin County Commissioner Otis Amason are watching carefully. Amason owns a seafood company and has lived in the area all his life, except for his military service.
As far as the bay goes, our foundation is the oyster bars. And that has an effect on every little thing out there. If those oyster bars aren't healthy and thriving, it affects fish all the way to 50 miles offshore. So that goes for tarpon, speckled trout, you know, everything. Snappers, groupers, all the way down the line.
The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has approved a management plan to partly reopen the bay. It will run from the beginning of January through February, then a regular fall season starting in October 2026.
Maybe we can get it back there. I mean, that's the goal, is to get the bay back. A healthy bay is not just going to help the commercial oystermen, but it's going to help the farmers, it's going to help the guide fishermen, it's going to help everybody.
Now the economy is drifting more to ecotourism, to people who come for the remaining beauty of the forgotten coast. I'm Margie Menzel.
Floridians can keep bees in their backyard. Honeybees are vital to food and wildlife in the state. Despite threats like disease and habitat loss, bee populations are on the rise in Florida. As WUSF's Gabriella Paul reports, that's thanks in part to backyard beekeepers.
In the last decade, the number of beekeepers has doubled in Florida. More than 90% of them are backyard beekeepers. That means they tend to fewer than 40 hives at a time. I joined a group of them on a recent Saturday in Pinellas County. I was one of several people there to learn about beekeeping. My first lesson was what not to wear.
Oh, you did not come dressed for bees.
No?
No, you came dressed directly opposite for bees.
Oh, no.
Bears have a thing about.
That's Jim Runyon. He's a volunteer with the Pinellas County Beekeepers Association. He says bees can't tell the difference between an all-black outfit and they're natural predators.
Oh, so I look like a bear?
Yeah.
That's not great, I take it.
No, not out here in the yard.
Well, I already learned something.
I told her how to get here, but I didn't tell her what not to wear.
Behind us is a bee apiary. It's essentially a neighborhood for the bees. This one has 20 hives. They're made up of stackable wooden boxes with removable frames. It's a beekeeper's job to open them one by one.
We'll take a frame out of each hive, look at it, see if they have sufficient resources for the bees, see if the queen is laying eggs. We may find the queen, we may not. She's very elusive.
Across the apiary, Maura Scanlon checks in on the male bees first. They're called drones. She says they're only good for one thing around here.
Oh, there's a drone right in the middle.
Right there.
Yep.
That's a drone.
Okay. You see how he's bigger?
He's chunky.
He's a chunky monkey. And he doesn't do anything except fertilize the queen. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't feed the other bees. He's not a nurse bee. He doesn't forage. He doesn't sting even. He's a bum who basically mates with queens. And then in the fall, they'll actually kick all the drones out of the hive.
And in Florida, we've had some busy bees. Despite major threats like disease, habitat loss, and queen quality issues, the state's bee population is on the rise. Amy Vu is a bee expert with UF IFAS, the university's research arm for agriculture and food science. She says backyard beekeepers play a crucial role in supporting honeybees in Florida.
Many of them are advocates for the honeybees. The backyard beekeepers are really the ones that are getting other people involved and bringing awareness out to the general public about bees and the importance of bees to our food system.
There's over 100 kinds of fruits and vegetables that rely on pollination by bees. This increases crop production in Florida, giving the economy an estimated $65 million boost every year. That's on top of the money brought in from the honey industry, which also thrives in the state. Back at the beehive, Runyon shows some first-time beekeepers how it's done.
The white that you see up at the top, that's all honey, capped honey. The honey capping is solid. Water can't get in it, air can't get in it. That's why honey will last forever.
Honey will never go bad.
What's that?
Honey will never go bad.
You're correct, it won't.
Bees make more than honey, too. They make propolis, often called bee glue. They make beeswax. They also make medicinal honey with healing properties, says beekeeper Tony Lupo.
I had someone recently come over. She was bleeding. She heard that if you put honey on it, it stopped the bleeding. It worked.
So what I'm learning is that bees are magic.
They are masters at their craft.
Lupo was recently awarded Volunteer Beekeeper of the Year. Today, she wins the title of Queen Bee Spotter, too.
I got the queen.
You do? A queen. Let me see her.
She's right there.
Oh my gosh, you can tell she's a lot longer.
Yeah, she's longer and she's got a dark tail.
Can you see her?
So if you want to take this and let the kids see, come around.
There's the queen. Okay, I'm going to put this frame back in so she can continue to do her work.
Like the worker bees in a beehive, backyard beekeepers work together at one very important task. And in Florida, our bees are better off because of them. I'm Gabriella Paul in Seminole.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, deep in the heart of the Florida Everglades lies the homeland for the Miccosukee tribe, recognized as a sovereign nation by the United States beginning in 1962. Generations there have developed a deep connection with the land. Tribal leaders say preserving their culture is a key to their survival. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford was given access to the tribe to learn how younger members are being inspired to keep their ancestral traditions flourishing.
At the Miccosukee Indian School, more than 160 students from preschool to high school head into classrooms each day for academic instruction. But here, tribal leaders say some of the most important lessons are learned outside the walls of the school, in this cooking chicky made of cypress wood and palmetto fronds. William Popeye Osceola is an elected member of the Miccosukee tribe and has taught at the school.
We're in the lifeblood of every camp. This is the cooking chicky. This is where grandma, aunts, sisters make food for the whole camp, keep everybody fed, keep everybody alive.
Smoke billows from the top of the thatched roof. On the ground, fire crackles under the open grill as 3 and 4-year-olds gather for culture day.
And then you put your finger like that. Every grade has at least one day of the month where they just do cultural activities that day. They're not going to be doing social studies, science, or math in the way that you expect. It might be incorporated in whatever activity it is, but we want them to understand this is just as important as their day-to-day life as anything else going on in that school.
Preschoolers clamor to the table to cut up fruit, make dough for pan bread, and slice up spam, a staple in their modern-day diet.
How old are you?
We want them to be involved from that little childhood age, being a baby, all the way to an adult, even when they're an elder. All stages of life have some impact on what's being done day-to-day.
Go, go, go. Squeeze the heart. All right, why not?
The 1972 Indian Education Act, it's because of that act we're able to implement our culture in the school in the way we are. And for us, it's the most important thing. Like everything we have here as a government, as a school, modern operation, is to keep the culture alive. So of course we have that culture embedded into the curriculum.
The Miccosukee Indian School Administration Building, Police Department, and Community Health Center anchor the Miccosukee Reservation located off Tamiami Trail, just a few miles east of the Collier-Dade County line.
The Miccosukee Tribe was the first federally recognized tribe to assume operations of its police, health, and school. We basically told the government back in the early 70s, we know how to run this better than you do for our community, so let us do this.
Tribe officials say the majority of the tribe's 670 members live in modern houses with outside cooking chickies. But an estimated 200 to 300 tribal members live in traditional Indian villages or clan camps.
We've lived in the Everglades on a more permanent basis for almost 200 years now. After the Seminole Wars, when we were pushed out here for survival,
22 villages dot the landscape of Collier and Dade counties just off Tamiami Trail. Most are in the Big Cypress National Preserve. Green Indian Village signs mark the locations from the road. Like this one, the village sits within about 1,000 feet of the newly built controversial immigrant detention facility, Alligator Alcatraz. Popeye says his grandma Peggy, almost 100, has lived here her entire life, and it's where he brings his nephew.
And then chuck it straight down at the water. That's better.
And other children to teach them the traditional way to fish and the importance of the Everglades environment in their culture.
Whenever we take the kids out gigging so they can get fish, teach them how to do that so they can survive. That's out in the Big Cypress. You see this firewood? We get this wood from the land still. That's from the Big Cypress. We got to do medicine. That's from the Big Cypress. We need to hunt a deer, a pig. That's from the Big Cypress. If I want to go to my grandma's camp, that's out in the Big Cypress. If I want to go to corn dance, our biggest cultural ceremony, that's out in corn dance in Big Cypress.
Children from villages in the Big Cypress attend the Miccosukee School with the reservation kids. Almost all are members of clans.
We're here with my niece, Hayatli, or June. I graduated here with her mom at Miccosukee Indian School. We're both bird clan. We say Fujadet. Here at Miccosukee, we still have six clans. We have bird clan, Wind Clan, Otter Clan, Panther Clan, Big Town Clan, and Dagojabi Clan. It's just another layer of relations between each other. So you have blood relations and clan relations, and they're just as important as the other. There might be people in the community I'm not related to by blood, but because they're bird clan, they're just as connected to me as any other way.
Oh. All right, I think this is ready though.
Popeye says empowering the youngest tribal members with the knowledge of the Miccosukee language, culture, and heritage.
I love you. Can I get a kiss?
Is imperative to ensuring survival of the Miccosukee for generations to come.
That was WGCU's Jennifer Crawford reporting from the Everglades. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Tristan Wood, and Margie Menzel. And speaking of Margie, she's retiring from WFSU Public Media after 2 tenures in our news operation. The respect her reporting has engendered amongst our local and statewide listenership can't be overstated. We'll miss her journalistic expertise and deep community connections, but most of all, we'll miss her cheerful persistence and the ability to coax candid statements from even the most offensive subjects, and always with a smile. Thanks also to Douglas Soule, Chris Young, Gabriella Paul, and Jennifer Crawford. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.